Well, it feels like I haven't been in the class that much this past fall. I think this has been the busiest travel schedule I've ever had in the history of the ministry for a fall. So, but it's good to be back here. And I'll give you a quick report, and then I've got something new I want to try on you. I've developed a new message on Genesis 2, but I really appreciate your critique and feedback on it, because we're still trying to fine-tune it. So, because we may want to actually use that in some of our outreach events. But I was in Washington and Baltimore this past week. I was there for a little more than a week, which is why I missed a couple of Sundays. In the D.C. area, it was primarily in northern Virginia. I think that's where most of the suburbs of Washington now are located. And was in one church. Well, actually, what was really fun, we started off with a chapter meeting, the Washington, D.C. chapter. They had a couple hundred people show up for the chapter, so that was quite exciting. And they want to know all about the new building we're moving into. We're going to be moving into it probably the first week of December. They're still trying to get it ready. But they just asked me, can we have one of the rooms in the building named after the D.C. chapter? So we said, yeah. I mean, Jacksonville chapter is going to do that. So they all said, yeah, we're going to do that. We'll have one of the offices named after us. And I said, well, you can have your name on anything except the studio, because that's already been taken. The foyer's been taken. I said, and the restrooms have been taken. Kathy and I are funding the restrooms. So we figured that'd be the hardest thing to get funded, so we took care of that. But no, they're all excited about getting one of the offices with their name on it. And so it's fun that the chapters are rising up to that challenge. And then the church the next morning was quite interesting. It was three services, but they reserved about 40% of the service time for me just to field questions with the people in the pews. And we did three different subjects. But what was interesting about the senior pastor interviewed me, and with each service, he was kind of taking a Thanksgiving theme. You know, Hugh, what should we be thanking God for? So we talked about why we should thank God for 3 billion years of sulfate-reducing bacterial activity. And he said, well, that's a new one. I haven't heard that one before. So then we talked about how every one of the 8 solar system planets plays a crucial role in enabling us to enjoy Thanksgiving. So I want to know about each of the 8. So we talked about that. Anyway, it was an interesting time. And people walked out saying, you know, Thanksgiving will never be the same for us. And a lot of people attended all 3 services. And the evening, I went down to a place near Manassas and spoke at a church. And I was told ahead of time by our chapter people, this church is very strongly young earth. And they've heard about you, and a lot of them don't like you. So I said, well, this will be interesting. But what I discovered was they had believed that I believed things I'd never believed. And so the problem is there are actually organizations telling people that I believe things that I've never believed. So once they realized I didn't believe those things, things really relaxed. And I spoke on why the universe is the way it is. And that just seemed to get them over all the humps. And you know, the chapter people over there said, you know, this couldn't have gone better. There was zero opposition from the young earth creationists. Many of them had actually switched the position right there that night. So it was very exciting. Yes?
Young earth creation.
It depends where you are. If you're in the Bible Belt of the U.S., there's certainly the majority. I've seen it as high as 95%. So, but if you're in the Northeast or the Northwest, it's a minority view.
But so, if you average everything all out, what would it be?
Oh, if you average it all up for the United States, it's definitely the majority view. I'd say probably. Well, in terms of churches that believe the Bible is the Word of God, you know, mainstream churches that are kind of, you know, like this and about whether or not the Bible really is God's Word, yeah, young earth creationism isn't on, even on the radar screen. But for those churches that actually take seriously the Bible as God's Word, I would be guessing maybe 60 to 75% would be the young earth view. But a lot of them are young earth because they think they have only 2 options. They either have to go to theistic evolution or young earth creationism. And that's what happened in this church. Once they recognized that there was another position, that you didn't have to be a theistic evolutionist to be an old earth creationist, that just took all the pressure off. So it's, you know, it's a false dichotomy. People thinking they've only got two choices. So
how do they explain dinosaurs?
Well, I don't know. I regret saying this, but my colleague Buzz Rana, our staff biochemist, says one problem with younger creationist leaders is they think that the Flintstones is a documentary. But you know, that question actually came up. I mean, what about the dinosaurs? And just to explain, you know, well, you know, if they were indeed on creation day 5 before human beings showed up, what possible purpose do they show? And I says, well, you need to look at it in the context of Psalm 104. Psalm 104 teaches that God packs the planet with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible, for as long as possible. That's what we see in terms of a planet Earth. Life shows up here as early as the laws of physics will permit, and it continues for as long as the laws of physics would permit, which actually has consequences for us. It means we are at the end of the line. Life is not going to last much longer here on planet Earth. But by God creating life as abundantly and as diverse and as long as possible, it means that we human beings get to come at the very end and take advantage of all the biodeposits that past life has salted into the crust of the earth. And just simply explaining to the people that at a minimum, we're looking at 76 quadrillion tons of biodeposits, provable biodeposits. And, you know, just recognizing you're not going to get 76 quadrillion tons in a few thousand years. It's going to take a long time. But also shows you the blessing of God. In fact, this came up in the morning church that, you know, we are blessed to be on a planet that has had life that abundantly for that long, because that means we can build cities and freeways, we can have high technology. All that's thanks to the life that God put here. And it's the theme we talked about also in terms of the animals that God speaks about in the book of Job, making a point that those animals are crucial for getting us out of the Stone Age. Often we think we human beings did it all by ourselves. What you see in the book of Job especially is you won't make it without these animals that God created for us to use. And the proof of that is those continents that lacked those animals, because they killed them off too quickly, never got out of the Stone Age. So we need to put credit where credit is due. It's those 76 quadrillion tons minimum that actually makes it possible for us to get out of the Stone Age. Yeah.
Just one quick thing. I can prove that the uncreationists are wrong, because some of my jokes are older than 10,000 years.
Well, I'll use that one sometime. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to bring a picture that I saw in the Smithsonian magazine. It was a picture of your favorite thing there, the bird of shale. And they have a picture actually in there about the tribal bites and the pikeas and all that. Got it right there. So all these young Earth people should be taken up there free in a bus and have them look at the all the fossils there that were there.
Well, the young Earth model says all those fossils were laid down in the flood, but you bring up a good point. There's too many fossils, they're too diverse for all that to be explained by a 5-month event.
Was it 12,000 species or something like that?
Well, you know, when we took our group to the Burgess Shale this past August, you know, we were basically looking at small fossils. I mean, there's all kinds of them. A single rock would have 9 fossils in it. Not 9 trilobite fossils, plus a whole bunch of other species. I mean, it was really dense. But I said, what about the big stuff we see on TV? So if you want to see the big fossils, you've got to go to the Smithsonian, Washington, D.C. That's where the largest collection of the British Columbia Burgess Shale fossils exists in the world. It's right there in the Smithsonian. And there they got trilobites of really big sizes compared to the ones. Well, the biggest ones we saw were about that big.
They say they have one there that have five sets of eyes.
Well, what's interesting about the Cambrian explosion is you see the sudden appearance of a huge variety of eye designs. They all come at once at the same time. In fact, Fuzz Rana, that was one of the lectures he gave at our conference, was just the eyes that you see at the Cambrian explosion. And what's interesting about the Burgess Shale fossils is that the soft body parts are preserved. So you can actually see the intestinal tract, and you can look at the eyes and see all the structure in the eyes. And for example, in the Cambrian explosion, you see eyes like you do with flies, where they're, you know, multifaceted with a thousand different facets. That shows up right at the base of the Cambrian explosion. You get guys that move in different directions, eyes like ours. It's all there at the Cambrian explosion, where you literally go from no eyes at all to eyes in all this tremendous complexity. You know, Fuzz made the point that the fact that they all show up with such great diversity without any evolutionary history means that the Creator must have put them all. And He put them all there because that was the first moment that you actually have the sun, moon, and stars visible. That's when the prey and predator relationships become significant, so they have to be able to see. And what's interesting, too, is that the design of eyes for prey is different than the eyes of the predators. You know, the predators have to be able to see distance, so they typically have this binocular-type vision, whereas the prey, it's very important for them to be able to see the predators in a wide scope, so typically they got their eyes bent. Look at a mouse, for example. The eyes aren't forward. They're at the sides. That's so it can kind of see, and they don't really need to know exactly the distance of the prey or how fast it's moving. They just need to know it's there. And so they know it's there, then they begin to make their escape. Whereas if you're trying to hunt something, you've got to be able to very accurately determine the distance and the velocity, and that's where having eyes like ours would that really apply. So I guess we're in the predator category because we've got eyes that can actually do binocular focus. But that also thinks that God not only gave us that so we'd be good predators, but also so we could read stuff like this. So
that was our ancestors there too. Phycaea survived. There was a chordate. If that hadn't survived, we wouldn't have been here.
Well, what's interesting about the Cambrian explosion is that you get all the body plans all at once. There's no evolutionary history. And the chordates show there right at the base of the Cambrian explosion. You know, the evolutionary model would predict maybe, in fact, I read that when I was a child, when I was reading books on the Cambrian explosion. They said, well, the Cambrian explosion maybe was 40-50 million years in duration, and the chordates show up at the very end. The simple stuff shows up at the beginning. But now we realize the Cambrian explosion is not a 40 to 50 million year history. It's less than a 2 million year history. 2 million years or anywhere down to zero, and that the chordates show up right at the beginning. There's no development. As a matter of fact, you actually see vertebrates showing up at the base of the Cambrian explosion. Not all chordates are vertebrates, but the fact that you even see the vertebrates at the base of the Cambrian explosion. And, you know, that's, I think I gave you some quotes when I was here a few weeks ago, making the point that when you're looking at the latest comments by people writing reviews of the Cambrian explosion, they're basically conceding a materialist worldview explanation won't work. And every year that goes by, the materialist explanation is much more challenging. And even Richard Dawkins says these animals just come out of nowhere with no evolutionary history, without any explanation from a naturalistic perspective. Yes?
You were saying something about Genesis 2?
Yeah, I was going to say something about Genesis 2. So maybe it's time to get there. I'll talk about Baltimore next week. Actually, I'm going to be gone next week. I'm not having to get on an airplane, but I will be gone. I'm speaking to their church here in the Southern California area. But
you're coming to the Christmas
party. I will be at the Christmas party. Yeah, I say I don't have to go out of town. So, I mean, you know you're on the road too much when the pilots and the stewardesses recognize you. So, actually, what's kind of fun is there's an airline pilot that's the president of our Arizona, from your Phoenix, Arizona chapter. So when I'm on U.S. Airways, I quite frequently see him flying the plane. So that's kind of fun. He gives me an update what's happening with the chapter. Okay, well, the new take we have on Genesis 2 is that it's not just a text about apologetics, but also about humanity's mission. And so kind of looking at Genesis 2 is God assigning humanity responsibility and authority and telling them what their overarching mission is. Now, people wonder why there's two accounts of creation back to back. I mean, you got Genesis 1, then you got another account that immediately follows Genesis 2. What you notice about Genesis 1 is that its focus is predominantly what physical miracles God has done bring about life here on planet Earth. And something that's often missed by secular people looking at the text, it actually speaks about three different origins of life. And so on creation day one, it's the origin of life as purely physical. Creation day five, the origin of life is not only physical, but also soulish. Then last of all, the one and only species, creation day six, that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. Or to put it another way, you know, God creates a soulish life in creation day five that's designed to serve and please a higher species. And in creation day six, he creates us, who he designs to serve and please him, a higher being. And what Genesis 2 does is God introduces Adam step by step to the three different forms of life. So he begins by introducing him to the life as purely physical, then the life as physical and soulish, and last of all, he saves the introduction to Eve, the first creature that Adam meets besides God, that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. Now, as you may be aware, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are roundly attacked and mocked by skeptics because they think they're contradictory. In fact, this has been the birth of higher criticism theology. You know, when I was in Baltimore, I was attending the Evangelical Theological Society convention. They have it every year in November, and this year attracted over 2,400 pastors and theologians. We had a booth there. It was really quite exciting, all the activity we had at the booth there. But there was a concern that we're seeing a revival of higher criticism theology. It's actually something I'm writing about in my book on Genesis that's coming out in January, that there's the old criticism of the 19th century, but we got a new criticism. But it's interesting how both of them focus on what they appear to be contradictions in the text. But we need to appreciate that in Genesis 1, the physical events are sequence, but not the relational events. Whereas in Genesis 2, the relational events are sequence, but not the physical events. That's basically the core of the criticism, that Genesis 1 presents a different order of events than Genesis 2. But it's only a different order if you think they're both dealing with physical creation events. And in fact, that's not the case. Genesis 1 is physically focused, but not Genesis 2. What's happening in Genesis 2, God is step by step telling Adam what his responsibility and authority is, and he ends the chapter by telling him what their mission will be. So that's kind of where we're going with all this. And therefore, what you get in Genesis 1 is a single sentence that talks about man's responsibility and authority. It's the sentence where God tells Adam and Eve, after he's created them, I'm putting you in charge of the planet to manage its resources for the benefit of all life. And since green plants are the base of the food chain, you better take care of the green plants, because if you don't, nobody gets to eat. All life is dependent on green plants. So that's the only thing you got in terms of Genesis 1 talking about humanity's responsibility and authority. Now, when you go into Genesis 2, it's the opposite. You get a single sentence that talks about the physical events, but the rest of it is dealing with the relational events or the responsibility and authority that God is assigning. So this is where the new critics and the higher critics of the 19th century went. They claimed that Genesis 2:5 gives a different order of physical events than what you see in Genesis 1. So it's, you know, what's happening, and you can read it for yourself, it's talking about the Garden of Eden, and makes the point that before the Garden of Eden was planted by God, there were no shrubs, plants, rain, or humans. Well, people are thinking that what the text is saying is shrubs came first, then plants, then rain, then humans, whereas in Genesis 2, it says the rain comes first, and then the plants and shrubs, and then the humans. So they say, look, it's a contradiction. But what they're failing to recognize is that Genesis 2:5, there's nothing in the text that says this is a chronological sequence. It's simply an abbreviated list. Notice that Genesis 1 talks a lot more, it mentions a lot more about the physical events than just these four items. So it's basically just taking out four selected items from Genesis 1 and putting together in an unordered list. Whereas we go to Genesis 1, look at all the clues that this is in a tight chronological sequence. It's ordered with 6 days, day one, and day two follows after day one, day three follows after day two. You've got the phrase, and it was so. By the way, that phrase, and it was so, means what follows after the phrase, and it was so, comes later than what happened before. So again, it's emphasizing the fact that the events of Genesis 3, day 3, take place after the events of Genesis 2. So it's actually giving you, you know, it orders it as 6 days. You got the phrase, and it was so, which is basically emphasizing this is a chronology. But notice none of that language is present for the physical events in Genesis chapter 2. It's missing. Yes.
Could you see the order of importance from least to most?
The order of importance? No, I'm arguing that this is just simply a list. And it's not a complete list. It's just a few of the highlights. It's basically giving you a link back to Genesis 2. It's Moses basically saying, look, we talked about this in Genesis 1, and just kind of gives a reminder here, just like what we have in Genesis 1 is a very short statement on responsibility and authority without any kind of attempt to order it or chronologize it. Whereas in Genesis 2, notice what God does. He introduces Adam first to the physical creation, then the soulless creation, and last of all to the spiritual creation. And there you do have a tight chronological sequence. But the chronology is for the spiritual events, not the physical. Whereas in Genesis 1, the chronology is for the physical events, but not the chronology. And therefore, there's no basis for saying that there was a contradiction. Another place where the critics go is verse 19. Where it talks about Adam, and then it talks about the birds and the mammals, then it talks about Eve. And again, they think that what they got there is an order, and they say that contradicts what you've got in Genesis 2. If you read verse 19, it's simply saying, well, here's Adam, and then it mentions the birds and mammals. It doesn't say they're created then, just says they exist then, and then we have God talking about Eve. So in that sense, there is no basis for the charge that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 contradict one another in terms of chronology. Another place where the new critics and the higher critics go is, by the way, when I'm talking about the new critics, I'm talking about, and by the way, they were there in force at the Evangelical Theological Society conference. All of them were there who've written books making the point. And it's a different tack in the sense what's happening now, if you've got theologians saying Genesis 1 and 2 say nothing about science or creation. And since it's silent about science and creation, there's no possibility that it can conflict with what we see from the record of nature. But it's very difficult to convince anyone outside the Christian faith that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are saying nothing about creation or science. Matter of fact, when I first picked it up, having not met Christians, it was very obvious to me this was a description of physical events. But another charge I've heard is that Genesis 2 is actually claiming that the Garden of Eden is a worldwide phenomenon, that it covered the entire planet. But if you actually look at the text carefully, it tells us, and you know, of course they ridicule that, saying, how is that possible given that we got Greenland and Antarctica? How can the Garden of Eden actually cover the whole globe? But verse 8 tells us that the Garden of Eden is in the east. Well, how can it be global if we're told that it has a location that's east of somewhere else? That doesn't make sense. We're also told it's a place where four rivers come together. The Pishon from Havilah, the Gihon from Cush, and the Tigris and Euphrates from Asher. So there's talking about four rivers, two of which we all know from our textbook history, the Tigris and Euphrates. The land of Asher is the land of Mesopotamia. So those rivers are well identified. The fact that the text is speaking about four different rivers gives the geographic location of those rivers means that the Garden of Eden has to be a relatively small locale on planet Earth. It can't be encompassing the whole planet, and it can't be as big as, say, a million square miles. We're talking a relatively small place. Now, I think the garden was big by our standards, but it wasn't something that would encompass what we envision today as an entire nation. And actually, we do know where Havilah and Cush are. Cush you've probably heard of if you're a student of Scripture. Cush is referring to that region in eastern Africa known as Ethiopia, the Horn of Africa, and talks about the mountains of Cush. And then there's the land of Havilah, and we're told that in the land, the text actually tells us. What does it tell us about the land of Havilah? It's a mountainous region where gold is found. Okay? And Havilah has actually been identified with Central Arabia for many millennia. So if we were to look at this map here, maybe we could dim some of the lights. And by the way, you can go online and get this. All you need to do is put in your search engine, Arabian Peninsula, and this map will come up. And the one that might be really fun to look at, there's one online that you can get where it has about 2,600 pixels versus about 2,600 pixels. So it's an extremely high definition image. But these are the mountains of Havilah, and then Cush is down here. But what's interesting is that at the close of the last ice age, almost all of the Red Sea was dry. Because, you know, with ice being over Siberia and Canada, that would have pushed the continental masses down into the mantle of the earth and would have pushed the intervening seas up. So almost all the Persian Gulf would have been dry. Likewise, Persian Gulf and the Red Sea would have been dry, which means that the mountains of Cush could actually extend from Africa right into southwestern Arabia. And that would have all been, there would have been a land bridge there. Now, this doesn't show up too well here because the resolution isn't adequate, but through satellite imagery, you can see the riverbeds of two giant rivers that are now dry. The Tigris and the Euphrates are still flowing. They're still flowing because they're able to get water from the melting of snow and ice in the mountains of Armenia. And those Armenian mountains are basically what's sustaining the Tigris and the Euphrates to this day. At the close of the last ice age, these mountains were covered with snow and ice. And the melting of that snow and ice is what fed the Pishon. And the Pishon, and they were told in the text, winds through the mountains of Havilah where there is gold. Well, the only place in Arabia where you can find gold is in this region. So these are the mountains of Havilah, and actually you can see a river that winds through this region like this and flows out into the Persian Gulf right here. And then you can also see another ancient riverbed which comes into the Persian Gulf just about here. So this is the Gihon, or pardon me, the Pishon. The Gihon comes from here and flows basically this way into the mountains of southwestern Arabia. And so it talks about the Gihon flowing out of the mountains of Cush and the Pishon coming out of the mountains of Havilah. They both flow right into here. Now, in terms of where this Garden of Eden is, there's Asher, here's Cush, here's Havilah. So we know the geographical locations of the four great rivers, and that's been the traditional location for the Garden of Eden. But notice it doesn't work. Two of the rivers flow into the southern portion of the Persian Gulf, and two flow into the northern portion of the Persian Gulf. They don't come together. But if we're talking about a time when the Persian Gulf is almost entirely dry land, then indeed you can have the Garden of Eden right there where the four rivers indeed come together. So, in that sense, we do appreciate that the Garden of Eden is a small locale on planet Earth where four rivers come together, and it's in the east. And we're also told that the land of Nod is east of Eden. So that's another an indicator that it is a locale. So where's the land of Nod? It'd be probably somewhere over here in what is now Iran. That would be east of Eden. And so, by the way, don't go to the land of Nod quite yet. Yes?
How does that gel with, who was Adam and that the first men were from Africa?
Well, that's a good point because, you know, the DNA evidence is telling us we get the greatest genetic diversity in modern humanity in Africa, not in this location. So, and you know, the model there is assuming that the Garden of Eden would have to be consistent with the location of where you got the greatest genetic diversity. That's an assumption. But assumption presumes that we human beings are random migrators. We're not random migrators. The DNA evidence testifies that we're not random migrators, because what the DNA evidence tells us is that humanity remained in one locale for a significant period of time, and for a brief period of time, there was an extremely aggressive migration that took place. And the DNA evidence even gives us the roots of that migration. Namely, one route was to follow along the southern shore of Asia. And thereby, humans got to Southeast Asia quite quickly, to Japan. There was a land bridge that joined Korea to Japan, so they were able to take advantage of that to settle Japan. All that happened just by going along the south and the eastern portion of the Asian continent. Humans went over Siberia into Alaska and basically migrated down the western shore of North and South America. In fact, only in a few hundred years, humanity was able to go from Alaska all the way down to the horn of the southern horn of South America. Extremely rapid migration. And the DNA evidence tells us that humanity was in one locale for a long period of time, then very aggressively migrated, and having migrated, stopped migrating. Now what that means is we're not random migrators. And by the way, that story is consistent with Genesis 10. Because, you know, up until Genesis 10, humanity was in one locale. And what it tells us in Genesis 10, in response to God's intervention after the flood, where he scatters humanity over the face of the earth and sets up nations. He scatters the people, they set up nations, the nations take root, and this prevents the repetition of the evil that took place in the days before the flood. You know, God recognized one nation that governs all the peoples of the world as a prescription for runaway evil. And so God's plan has been multiple nations competing with one another for citizens. Or you could put it another way, it's God's antitrust legislation. Just like we make sure there are multiple corporations, because we know if there's only one corporation in charge of a product, they'll do two things. They raise the price and lower the quality. But if they got competition, they're not going to be able to do that as easily. Likewise, God's intent is there to be multiple nations competing with one another for citizens as a prescription to stop oppression. And hey, if you remember your American history, that's the testimony of the United States of America. We basically became the nation we are by taking in immigrants from nations that were oppressing their citizens. And so, you know, here is America. They could leave their nation and go to us. And so, anyway, we're a little bit off track there. Yes?
I was wondering, what is the time range that would be considered the end of the last ice age?
Well, it depends what you mean by the end of the last ice age. Some people claim that we're still experiencing the end of the last ice age because we've got glaciers that are melting in certain parts of Canada and in Greenland. And so the full effect of the melting of the ice as a result of the last ice age is not quite yet finished. But in this context, I think we're interested in terms of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden had to date far enough back in time there'd be a significant snowpack on the mountains of Havilah and the mountains of Cush in southwestern, and we're talking about at least 20,000 years ago. But we could be talking a lot earlier than that, you know, 60,000 years ago. But the whole point is the Garden of Eden existed at a time when all four of these rivers were big, steady, flowing rivers. And now only two of them are. And when the ice finally melts over Armenia, then those two rivers will also dry up. But there was a time when all four rivers were in place. Yes?
Why do you think the text spends so much time on these four rivers? Are they trying to say maybe that the garden was really big and encompassed all of the rivers?
Well, there's a few things there. Notice that Adam and Eve are quite comfortable in the Garden of Eden without any clothes. And so this has to be a place where it's sufficiently tropical that they don't feel the need for clothes. So So, you know, putting the Garden of Eden up, say, around Nineveh would be a problem, because there you do get temperatures cool enough where the lack of clothing would be an issue. But if you're talking, you know, this part of the Persian Gulf, and also it's a place where we're told that there was waters coming up from below. We know there's a huge aquifer underneath the Persian Gulf. So all that would fit that location. And yeah, and it is interesting. The text gives you a lot of detail. Talks about the wealth of the region, the resources that were there. Basically, I think the point was this. God put Adam and Eve in a garden where they had everything that they could possibly want. I mean, they had the ideal temperature. They had the animals they needed. They had this really lush garden that God had provided. And then it talks about, you know, just the resources of the minerals that they had there. They had it all. And maybe the point is this, in the context of Psalm 104. You know, God has packed the earth with sufficient life that we have everything we need to fulfill our purpose. We don't lack the resources to fulfill the purpose that God has given us, which I think is significant for where I'm going to try to take this lesson on Genesis 2, namely that Genesis 2 ends with God explaining to Adam and Eve their mission. But first it begins by saying, you've got the resources you need for your mission. It's kind of like when I talk to my sons and say, this is what I want you to do. And they say, Dad, I can't do it. Well, I got to tell them, look, you've got all these resources. Take advantage of them. Then you can do it. I think God is doing the same thing here with Adam and Eve. Yes.
I have another question. On chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, we don't have any rain yet, but a mist used to come up from the earth and water the whole surface of the ground. Now, we're talking about rivers here, and I'm not quite sure how that fits. And there's another question that relates to that, which is after the flood, God sets the rainbow in the sky, which, of course, when you're having rain from the sky, you'll get rainbows.
Right.
So, did we not have any rainbows until after the flood?
Well, there are people who claim that's the right way to read the text.
Okay.
And the word that's being used there in Genesis chapter 2, it's actually contrasting two kinds of rain. And the Hebrew words are ed and matar. And one of those words means raindrops falling from the sky.
Uh-huh.
The other word means small raindrops falling from the sky. In both cases, it's raindrops falling from the sky. And hey, whether the raindrops are small or whether they're large, you're going to get rainbows. So rainbows have been around all along. Moreover, you can use a theological principle there. Because notice that God in Genesis 9 uses the rainbow to sign a covenant with the human race. It says, see the rainbow? Well, a pattern you notice with covenants that God makes with the human race is he always uses something that's familiar to humanity as a sign for the covenant. So he's basically saying to Noah, these rainbows you've been seeing, from now on when you see that rainbow, that's a sign that I'm going to keep my promise to you.
So you're concluding that rainbows were there kind of from the beginning.
Rainbows were there from the beginning. Genesis 2 would prove that. Genesis 9 would prove that. Because Genesis 2 is basically saying there was this mist that came down. That's still small drops of rain. It's going to give you a rainbow.
It says it came up from the earth.
Well, it's basically, again, right now we're kind of looking at Job 37, all the different kinds of precipitation God's given us. You're giving a hint of this in Genesis 2. Because notice the different sources of water. In other words, it's saying, you've got this lush garden, and look at all the water resources I've given you. To keep this garden very lush. There's mist, there's water coming up from the ground, and you got the four rivers coming in. I mean, you've got all the water you need to produce a whole range of plants. I would guess, for example, where you're really close to those four rivers, you would put your plants or trees that need a lot of water. You know, like a weeping willow will need 6,000 gallons of water a day. So you're going to want to have that right by the rivers, right? But when you're far away from the rivers is where you could have the plants that thrive best with a minimal amount of rain. You don't want them saturated with water. So it's basically telling us God planted this Garden of Eden with the full range of water resources you're going to need to have this great variety of life that I've given you to enjoy. So that's why I think it's mentioning different sources of water. Yeah.
As far as the source of the water, we know, I think we know, geologically speaking, the source of the water is originally comes from the earth. You got the, you know, the formation of the earth, the impact of the that's carrying water to the earth, and that's where the you know, this water eventually came to the surface of the land surface, and then eventually released into the space above the land. So that's, I mean, if you're talking about the water coming from down, coming from down going up, or going, or from down going, or from up going down.
From up going down or down going up?
Up going. It first has to go up from going down, because that's where the water originated.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you got subterranean water, you got water coming from the sky above, and you got the rivers. So, yeah, what more could you ask in terms of, yeah, in the back here?
So after the flood, Noah's flood, supposedly the rainbow was God's covenant to say no more floods, but was there an asterisk there saying that typhoons and tsunamis are okay? What's that about?
Well, I mean, as we're going to be looking at in our study of the water cycle, we need typhoons and hurricanes. Things would be a lot worse if there weren't typhoons and hurricanes. I'll let you think about that. I talk about it in more than a theory. But what the promise that we're getting the text here is never again will there be a flood that will wipe out all of humanity. So a flood that kills 10,000 people, no problem. But a flood that wipes out all of humanity, that won't happen. So that's the promise that you see here.
How many people are on earth? Wiped out.
Well, I don't think the human population at that time could have been any higher than several million. Maybe the low tens of millions would be maximal. Because if there was more people than that, we would have archaeological remains. We have no archaeological remains of the pre-flood peoples, and therefore their population couldn't have been that high. Moreover, I would say it couldn't have been that high because of the description of the pre-flood peoples as being incredibly evil and malicious. And if you actually look at the Hebrew words to describe the population that existed at that time, is that they were wreaking bodily harm on one another left and right, which means that the number one cause of death would have been murder. And so they were killing one another off, and that's why the human population didn't get to be very large. In fact, I would argue that the average lifespan today is probably longer than the average lifespan of the people that lived in the days before the flood. Even though they had the potential to live 900 years, the fact that the murder rate was so high meant that the average longevity for the human population was less than the 80 years we experience today.
Were there a lot of murders within families? Father, son, murderers, that kind of stuff?
Well, just read chapter 4 of Genesis. You know, it talks about Cain murdering his brother, and then you get a few generations down, and then you've got this guy Lamech who's murdering all kinds of people.
What's his name, Lamech?
Yeah. Yeah, check out Genesis 4. I mean, things get really bad. So, yes.
Getting back to the rainbows. Rainbows, you can see them if you're behind. If you're behind them and the sun is behind your back,
right,
that the people from the other side cannot see them, right?
Right.
Because you got to have the sun hitting the water molecules to exactly right.
Right.
So.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're around enough, you're going to be in the right spot to see them. So.
Well,
I don't know. I see rainbows several times a year. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I do too. As far as the timeline, I'm confused with the timeline. The people of Africa came out in what, 50,000 years ago?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up, because I never really answered your question, did I? We got diverted. Okay. Why is it that you have this great genetic diversity in Africa and not elsewhere? Well, okay. The easy migration routes are the south shores of the continents, as I was mentioning. Another easy migration route is to go up a big river, because typically the bank and you got water there, and you know, in terms of what really facilitates large-scale migration is an easy pathway and lots of free food. And so one reason why the western shore of North and South America was such an easy migration route, you could walk along the beach, there was firewood there just because there's all kinds of driftwood, and then there's clams and oysters you can just pick up right off the beach, and there's fish out there. And along the shore, you got berries. I mean, I tell a story of my father when I was like maybe I was 7 years of age. My father took me and my two younger sisters out to the beach in pouring rain. And he took no food. Says, I'm going to show you how to survive out here. And so the first thing he did is he had us go to driftwood. And to break open the driftwood, there will be dry wood, even though it's pouring rain outside. So we get that dry stuff, it's kindling, and we use that to build a little, what he had us do first is we built a lean-to. And he says, the lean-to is not for you, it's for the fire. Because, you can't start a fire in pouring rain. So we built a lean-to, and we collected this stuff out of, this dead driftwood, and got the dry stuff in the core. We put it underneath the lean-to, we lit the fire, then we burned up the lean-to, and that got the fire going well. Then he said, okay, now we're going to build a lean-to for us. So we built this big lean-to so we could sit by the fire and to get warm when we needed to. Then he told us to go out and go swimming, so we went out swimming. It's pouring rain, who cares, you're getting wet anyway, right? And so then he said, well, now it's time for dinner. And so what he had us do is collect clams and oysters along the beach, and then we went out and got berries along the trees that were there. And he showed us how to pick out some wild lilies. Wild lilies and onions are always good to eat. We picked dandelions. We had a feast there. So that was an important lesson. But I thought about it years later, saying that's why people could move from Alaska down to the southern tip of South America so fast. They had a place they could walk, and they also had readily available food and readily available shelter all the way down, and makes for rapid migration. But another place you can do that is along the shores of a big river. And so people could easily come into the Garden of Eden, walk along the Gihon, down through Kush, and over into Africa, because there was a land bridge here. And in the central eastern portion of Africa is where you got the greatest genetic diversity. Not at all surprising, since it's a fairly easy walk to get there. And the thing we've noticed about the African peoples is they practice genetic diversity far more so than the rest of us. And remember your history, where you got David Livingston, the missionary, going into the Congo. And what does he find in the Congo jungle? He finds a tribe there where the average height is 3.5 feet. And then a few miles away, another tribe where the average height is 7 feet. They wouldn't intermarry. And so they sustained their genetic diversity by the way they had their cultural marriage practices set up. And where's the greatest genetic diversity today? It's basically in southern Africa, where you got these black Bantus next to these black Zulus. And they do look a little different. I've been down there. The Zulus are much blacker than the Bantus, which tend to have a little bit of a brown tint in their skin. But what they've discovered is you've got greater genetic diversity between the Bantus and the Zulus that are living just a few miles apart from one another than you do between the Zulus and the whites, or the Bantus and the whites, or the Zulus and the Asians, and the Bantus and the Asians. So skin color isn't everything. The shape of the face actually tells you a lot more about the genetic diversity. But the point is, they maintain their genetic diversity, whereas people elsewhere on the planet Earth didn't, because they would, easily intermarry with one another. And so, and by the way, genetic diversity is rapidly disappearing from our planet because of the fact that now even the Bantus and the Zulus are willing to marry, whereas before they wouldn't. Yes.
I had a question on verse 9 of chapter 2 about the tree of life.
Yes.
The tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Yes.
What exactly does it mean that it's good and evil? And when Paul says in Romans chapter 8, verse 20, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected in hope, was the disobedience of the evil on the tree subjected to the planet of creation to the curse? And the second part question is in the hope, would humanity see the coming glory of Jesus Christ as Savior? Is that the hope? Or what exactly is
that? Okay, what's going on in Romans 8? You need to read from verse 18 all the way to verse 23. But it's talking about how God has subjected the entire universe to this pervasive law of decay. what we physicists would recognize as the law of entropy or the second law of thermodynamics. How no matter where you go, everything is decaying. Hey, look around you. You see plots of evidence that all of us are undergoing decay, right? So, look at this carpet. This carpet's been replaced 3 times in the last year. I mean, that's another evidence of a decay. By the way, I was told to say this as I walked in here today. This is the 3rd carpet they put in here. And by the way, this class donated for this carpet, so they want to make sure I express thanks to you for contributing to the carpet. So thank you. But they also told me, please tell the class, fill your coffee cup up only half full. Because when they pulled out those 2 carpets that needed to be replaced, there was a tremendous number of coffee stains they found on it. And my suggestion is, why don't we get a carpet that has a color of coffee stain? Then we'll solve the problem.
Did God create the tree with good and evil, knowing evil is going to be subjected to evil?
Well,
it would come to the glory of Jesus Christ to save the world? Or... Why did he put good and evil? I mean, good, okay, but why evil in the tree?
Okay, it says the knowledge of good and evil.
Okay.
Okay. There's 2 ways that you can be instructed or, you know, get explained. Let me put it this way. God's intent was that we would go to him for instruction about good and evil. But he also gave humanity the choice to experience the difference between good and evil firsthand. And that's why I said, don't eat of the tree of good and evil. I want you to be instructed. I don't want you to experience it. Okay, those of you who have been parents will realize that that's what we're trying to do with our children. We want to instruct them rather than have them experience evil firsthand. Adam and Eve chose to experience evil firsthand. And that's why there were consequences as a result of partaking of that evil. Exactly what the fruit is, I don't know. Just like we don't know exactly what the fruit or the leaves of the tree of life is. We do know that if they had partaken of the tree of life, they would have lived forever physically, which is why we see in Genesis 3:22, after Adam and Eve had eaten of the tree the knowledge of good and evil and are now experiencing evil for themselves, God says, we cannot let them eat of the tree of a life, because otherwise we'd be in the same spot as the demons. When the demons rebelled against God, their condemnation was secured at that point without possibility of redemption. God's intent was, okay, here we got these sinful people, they're experiencing evil, but I got a plan to redeem them. But that plan requires physical death. And so God did not want humanity living forever physically and being eternally lost spiritually. And so God is delivering us from the consequences of spiritual death through the tool of physical death. Because after all, far worse that we would have eternal spiritual death as opposed to eternal physical life. So, and then what it's talking about here is that, you know, God has subjected the entire universe to this law of decay. Now, as a physicist, I can tell you, you cannot separate the dimensions of space of the universe from the dimension of time. So when it talks about the entire universe being subjected to the law of decay, that not only means the entire breadth of the universe, but the entire history of the universe has been subjected to the law of decay. And if you go all the way to verse 23, it says that law of decay will remain in effect and to the full number of human beings who receive redemption has been met. Once that full number has been met, the law of decay will cease to exist. But it will cease to exist because the universe will cease to exist. And God's going to replace this universe with a brand new realm, the new creation we see in Revelation 21 and 22. So that's what God is talking about in Romans chapter 8 through the Apostle Paul. Which means that Adam and Eve were subject to the law of decay in the Garden of Eden. Now, they had a way to deal with the decay. They could have simply eaten of the tree of life, and that would have reversed the impact of the decay in their bodies. Which is why I would personally conclude that Adam and Eve rebelled against God relatively quickly. They did not wait long enough where they say, well, you know, my chin's starting to sag and my skin is starting to wrinkle up. I better go visit that tree of life. Evidently, they were not around long enough to notice that they were experiencing significant impact from the law of decay, so they didn't bother to eat at the tree of life, which means they probably sinned in something less than 150 years. So, yes.
I was wondering whether the antecedent for mist could be better translated as dew or drizzle. Which one of those might represent the...
The word there can mean any one of those. So, I mean, yeah, you can't be specific, which is why different translations translate it differently. Some will say mist, some will say dew. I've even seen some that say fog. So all that would apply. You're going to get water. I really stand by what I said earlier, namely that what it's telling us here in the Garden of Eden, I've given you abundant water to sustain this lush garden, and I've given you water in all the forms that you're going to need.
A drizzle would also be appropriate.
Yeah, and a drizzle, you're going to get a rainbow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that'll work. Basically, the difference between Ed and Matar is big drops of water compared to small drops of water. Now, how small the drops are is speculative. I mean, I grew up in coastal British Columbia, and mist for us was where the raindrops were less than 3/16 of an inch in diameter. We called that a mist. Here we would call it a downpour, but there they call it a mist. Yes.
If Adam and Eve didn't sin, would they have supposedly lived forever?
They had the potential to live forever, whether they sinned or didn't sin. All they had to do is take part of the tree of life. Because notice this, at the end of Genesis 3, Adam and Eve are now spiritually dead. But they have the potential to be eternally alive by taking the tree of life. Which is why God sends two angels with fiery swords to block access to the tree of life. Lets these people who are spiritually dead partake of that tree and live eternally in a physical state. Which means that they would be eternally in a fallen state. They'd be spiritually dead for all of eternity.
But now you said the law of decay has always been around, but yet Adam and Eve could have lived forever.
Yeah.
What about the law of decay there?
The law of decay was fully in effect. I mean, we just saw the verse during the introduction time how the laws of physics don't change over the whole history of the universe.
But they could have lived forever. Wouldn't that define?
But they had to take part of the tree of life. The tree of life was a means by which they could reverse the impact of the law of decay on their physical bodies. So think of it as a curative. I mean, here they are, they're decaying, and they say, wow, I don't like all these wrinkles, and I don't like what gravity's doing to my body. I'm going to go visit the tree of life. And it reverses the impact. And then they're set. Everything else would be decaying. So, I mean, think of it this way. Yesterday I did yard work, knowing full well in 2 weeks the yard is going to be just as messy as it was before I did the yard work. I can reverse the effects of the law of decay by inputting a lot of work. But in this case, Adam and Eve could reverse the impact of their decay in their physical bodies simply by visiting a tree of life and eating some of its fruit.
But you had to do it repeatedly.
Well, we don't know whether it had to be done repeatedly or whether one time would be enough. The text isn't clear. Maybe a one-time visit would be enough, or maybe they'd have to do it repeatedly. A lot of people think the repetition is probably the better translation of the term.
When they were first in the garden, they had an automatic and just run to the tree of life.
Well, that's why I think Adam and Eve must have rebelled against God relatively quickly, because they saw no need to go to the tree of life. You know, our bodies are fine. So let's not worry about it. When we begin to feel the impact of decay, then we'll go visit the tree of life. So after all, the law of decay is sufficiently gradual that it takes a while before you notice, gee, I'm not looking as young as I did. So you look at yourself in the mirror, if you look at yourself in the mirror tomorrow, you're not going to notice a big difference. Something you see in 2 Corinthians 4 is that, yes, our bodies are decaying, but they're decaying slowly. Which is the value of giving your life to Jesus Christ. Because giving your life to Jesus Christ, your spirit, as it says there in 2 Corinthians 4, if you're walking in the power of the Holy Spirit, your spirit gets renewed day by day. Which means in a single day, you can see the spirit of a Christian enhanced in a very measurable way. I've seen that with new Christians. I mean, literally in one day, you can see a transformation in the person. Whereas in the body, in one day, you're not going to be able to measure any physical decay. That takes years before you notice a decay. And, you know, one paraphrase I like is 2 Corinthians 4:16. We can rejoice in the rotten decay of our physical bodies, because that happens slowly, whereas the spirit within us transforms us day by day. And the significant part there is, as Christians, we can rejoice in the aging of our bodies, because what's happening spiritually is so much more dramatic. And you know, one thing I like to do is go into these rest homes where there are people who have been Christians for 5 or 6 decades. You know, you walk into a rest home room and there's someone there who's incredibly infirm from the physical decay, but you just love being in their presence because their spirit is glowing. And you know, it's just a marvel. In fact, I like my sons to experience it, to walk into a room and see what it's like to be in the presence of someone who's been walking faithfully with the Lord for 70 years. I mean, it really is a dramatic impact. Whereas I know people who dread going into rest homes, but they're dreading going to rest homes because there you've got people who don't believe and all you see is a decay. But for someone who's been walking in the power of the Holy Spirit, yes, go ahead.
You know, I don't know why I'm just thinking about the fact that Eden's in the middle of the Persian Gulf now. And does anybody know how long? I mean, because that would certainly keep you from being tempted to go back to the tree if it's fully underwater.
Yeah, if it's underwater there, you're probably not going to get to it.
But do they know about, I mean, it's way too long to know about the expulsion, but when did it fill with water, though?
There's some good evidence as to when it filled with water. For example, they have found evidence for an ancient berm that was right at the Gulf of Turmuz, which means that there might have actually been a physical block to the waters of the Indian Ocean coming in. And if we're talking the close of the last ice age, I mean, the Persian Gulf is quite shallow. So if sea levels are, say, 300 feet below what they are today, you're going to get almost all the Persian Gulf dry. And if you've got ice weighing down, say over here and up in Iran, that's actually going to push up the land in between. Typically, you get in an ice age about a 500-foot difference in the elevation between the bottom of, say, the Red Sea and where it would have been. So if it's under 500 feet elevation today or depth of ocean, it's going to be dry land. And that's true of both the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, that they're basically shallow seas. And so during the close of the last ice age, some other evidence, you'll see, I've written an article on this on our website at reasons.org, how they found 60 villages that rim the Persian Gulf. And those villages rank as the oldest villages ever found on the face of the earth. And the German archaeologists who found these 60 villages argues that the only explanation for the 60 villages perfectly rimming the present-day Persian Gulf is that people were moving up from the Persian Gulf oasis, the dry land there, in response to rising sea levels and just kept moving their villages up to higher and higher land. Because you actually see some villages at higher land again. So evidently they were responding to the rapid rise of the sea level and said, you know, we got to keep moving. So, and that date for those villages, 12,000 years ago. But for the Persian Gulf to be largely dry, you got to go back about 30,000 years ago. So, and it'd be different size. There's a lot of hands here. Yeah, Steve.
Your comments about the decay seem to be somewhat, in some sense, as far as human decay, somewhat relative, because pre-flood humans would typically live for many hundreds of years, Adam 900 years, that sort of thing. And so the thinking process about noticing aging and that sort of thing would be probably less for Adam than it would be for us in terms of...
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Is there a physical reason why we could see that humans lived for hundreds of years previously and no longer do?
Yes, three lines of evidence. Number one, one reason why we age faster than the pre-flood peoples is our chromosomes get shorter and shorter as we continue to live. And so that definitely hastens the aging process. Our hair goes gray faster, and our skin has its effect, the internal organs. That's why we're not going to live much past 120 years. The chromosomes get so short that we die. But one reason why we need that shortening of our chromosomes to be as aggressive as it is because of the environmental hazards to our health. And I'm arguing those environmental hazards were there to a lesser degree before the flood. The two most significant environmental hazards would be radiation from igneous rocks. If you've got granite in your kitchen, you're being exposed to the decay of uranium and thorium. And certain granites are more responsible for that than others. And even if you don't have granites in your kitchen, you've probably got concrete in your driveway. Mm-hmm. Or you've got concrete in the foundation of your home. Well, guess what? It's filled with igneous rocks. And there's radiation coming off of that. And we live in an area where there's a lot of igneous rocks just in the state of California. So if you live close to these mountains, you're being exposed to that kind of radiation. What we do notice, though, in the pre-flood peoples, if they were in one locale, say a big sedimentary plain, they'd be reasonably isolated from igneous rocks. And if they weren't importing those igneous rocks, once trade start happens, it's all over. But if they weren't trading in any significant way, they might have been substantially protected compared to us from the radiation from igneous rocks. The other factor is cosmic rays. If you live in Denver, you're going to live 3 months less on the average than you do here in Los Angeles, just because in Denver, you're exposed to more cosmic rays because of the higher elevation. And there's evidence from a Russian and a British astronomer that over 90% of the killer cosmic rays, basically fast-moving, high nuclei cosmic rays. Most cosmic rays are protons and electrons. They don't do that much damage. The ones that do damage are things like oxygen and iron nuclei moving at high velocities. That really messes up the proteins in your body. Well, there's evidence from this Russian and British astronomer, Ehrlichan and Wolfendale are the two people. They've been working on this for about 40 years. But they've now identified a large supernova remnant that's responsible for all these cosmic rays. A single supernova that exploded sometime in the last 100,000 years. Well, if it exploded at the time of Noah, that would explain why people before Noah could live so long and why we see an exponential decline in lifespans after Noah, as that radiation really begins to kick in. And so those are the three reasons I would give for why people in the days before the flood could live longer than us. And you say, well, why does God shorten our chromosomes so aggressively? Well, that actually prevents you from dying more rapidly from cancer. Because with all that radiation, you're going to have a much higher cancer risk. But with a lower cancer risk, you don't have to have your chromosomes getting shorter quite so aggressively. And so you wouldn't age as fast.
Could you give us some book recommendations and then book closing prayer that cover this topic in detail?
Well, some books that cover this topic in detail, we're actually releasing a new book on Genesis in January. It's going to be called Navigating Genesis. And I wrote a book on this called The Genesis Question 13, 14 years ago. And this book is a complete rewrite. Mainly because what I've been talking about earlier, the new criticism, the new theological challenge to looking at Genesis having to do with science and creation, we deal with that. I cut out parts on the origin of life and the origin of humanity because when I wrote the Genesis question, we didn't have a book on the origin of life and the origin of humanity. So I cut that part out to make room for a much more extensive discussion on the flood and especially the new scientific evidence that makes for a much stronger case of looking at the first 11 chapters of Genesis as the error-free, the inner word of God. Which, by the way, was really interesting at this conference in Baltimore of the Evangelical Theological Society, as how many theologians are concerned that Genesis 1 to 11 is a serious threat to biblical inerrancy. This book, The Navigating Genesis, basically makes the opposite argument that this is where we get our strongest evidence for biblical inerrancy. It's not our weakest evidence, it's our best evidence. And what I found amusing is all these theologians concerned about Genesis 1 to 11 being a scientific challenge to our understanding of the text as the error-free word of God, and yet none of them are scientists. So, we're hoping at the next conference they have, they're going to let us present some of the scientific evidence. for those 30 chapters. But yeah, that'll be out in January. And coming in May, we're going to be releasing a small group DVD series on Genesis chapter 1, kind of model like if God made the universe. But what's different about this series is the audience. Because when we did If God Made the Universe, several of you were actually part of the audience. But the criticism we got is the people in the audience knew way too much. So what we've done this time, we recruited people who had never heard of Reasons to Believe. And also they said, you know, some of the people in the audience were as old as you, Hugh. We need the younger people. So we had a rule. Maximum age was 34. So they were between the ages of 20 and 34. And some of them were not believers. So that was kind of interesting. We had people who were believers and some who weren't believers. The fun thing is, I think you'll see this when you see the series, these 15 people who were part of the audience, their lives were transformed by going through the 8-part series, especially the non-Christians. So I'm hoping they'll have some of their testimonies on at the end, because it's remarkable what they said about the series. They basically said this transformed our lives. And the other thing that I noticed, these 15 people, none of them knew one another. By the end of the 8-part series, they were friends. They're exchanging emails. They're continuing to meet with one another. So anyway, I think that's something that's special. So, Father in heaven, I want to thank you for this time we've had here in class. We thank you for the opportunity to spend time with friends and relatives during this Thanksgiving season. And Father, I pray you give each of us a grateful heart for, Lord, everything you've given to help us fulfill our destiny and purpose here on earth to get ready for the new creation. Father, I pray that you would just open up our minds and hearts to recognize the degree that you love us, the degree to which you've provided for us, but also, Lord, you would give a sense of why you've done this for us and the mission that you placed before us. And we'd be grateful, Lord, as you entrusted such an incredible mission to each one of us frail human beings. In Jesus' name, amen.